Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
For more than a century, tens of thousands of indigenous children were taken from their communities and forced into boarding schools run by the U.S. government, specifically the Department of the Interior and religious institutions.
A new report by the Interior Department has documented the deaths of 500 indigenous children at Indian boarding schools run or supported by the U.S. government. But the actual death toll is believed to be far higher. We'll speak with indigenous writer and historian Nick Estes. Then to Mexico, where three journalists have been killed this week, bringing the toll to 11 so far this year, making Mexico the deadliest country in the world for journalists behind Ukraine.
The wave of murders against the journalistic profession has become uncontrollable. Today, just as we are protesting here in Mexico City, in Tijuana and in Sinaloa, we learned the sad news that two of our colleagues were taken from their lives in Veracruz. It is carnage against journalists in our country.
Then Russia is threatening to take retaliatory steps after Finland's leaders announced plans to join NATO, ending decades of neutrality. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's ordered U.S. flags flown at half-staff as the White House marks 1 million deaths from COVID-19 since the first cases were detected just over 2 years ago.
Today, we mark a tragic milestone here in the United States. 1 million COVID deaths. 1 million empty chairs around the family dinner table. Each irreplaceable losses.
President Biden spoke from a virtual White House summit on the pandemic, where he called again on Congress to pass funding to combat COVID-19 at home and around the globe. Biden initially requested $22 billion from Congress in March, a figure rejected by public health advocates as too small. The request is now for $10 billion and remains stalled on Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, U.S. COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to rise. On Thursday, states reported over 115,000 new cases. That's likely a significant undercount due to an increase in home testing. The United Nations says more than 6 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia launched its invasion in February. A further 8 million people are displaced inside Ukraine. This comes as Ukraine's military continues to claim successes against Russian forces. Video footage released today appears to show a Russian ship on fire in the Black Sea after it was hit by what Ukraine's military said was a missile. In Washington, D.C., Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul delayed a vote Thursday on a bill to give an additional $40 billion in military and economic assistance to Ukraine. It's by far the largest foreign aid package in decades. Paul is demanding a special inspector general be given oversight of the aid money. His objections are likely to push a vote on the measure into next week when it's expected to pass. Meanwhile, Moscow's warned Finland over its plans to join NATO. The Kremlin condemned the move as hostile and threatened unspecified retaliation. In the past, Russia's threatened to station nuclear missiles on the Baltic Sea. We'll have more on Finland and NATO expansion later in the broadcast. In climate news, an investigation by The Guardian has found the world's biggest fossil fuel companies are quietly planning scores of oil and gas projects that would drive the climate past internationally agreed temperature limits with catastrophic global impacts. The Guardian's report on so-called carbon bombs found the short-term expansion plans of companies including ExxonMobil, Gazprom, and Saudi Aramco will produce greenhouse gases equivalent to a decade of carbon dioxide emissions from China, the world's biggest polluter. That's enough to shatter the Paris Climate Agreement's goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The Biden administration's canceled plans to auction off oil and gas drilling rights in three regions of the U.S. The decision will halt development affecting two parts of the Gulf Coast and roughly 1 million acres along the south coast of Alaska. Climate justice groups welcomed the move but said more urgent action is needed. A member of the group Earth Justice told CBS, quote, "The scientists are telling us the time to shift from fossil fuel energy is not years from now. It's today. We need to end offshore oil leasing," they said. The House committee probing the January 6th Capitol riot has subpoenaed five Republican Congress members, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, after they refused to voluntarily cooperate with the investigation. Also subpoenaed are Arizona Congressmember Andy Biggs, Alabama Congressmember Mo Brooks, Jim Jordan of Ohio, and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania. January 6th committee member Adam Schiff spoke to reporters on Capitol Hill Thursday.
Some were involved in the effort to overturn the election. Some spoke at the rally before the attack. One has said publicly that the president called him to rescind the election. They clearly have relevant testimony.
The New York Times reports a federal grand jury has issued at least one subpoena as investigators look into Trump's mishandling of classified documents. The probe centers on the 15 boxes containing government documents Trump took to his Mar-a-Lago resort when he left office in 2021. According to the Washington Post, those documents include items that were clearly marked as classified, including several labeled top secret. Israeli forces fired stun grenades and assaulted mourners carrying the casket of slain Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in Jerusalem today. Israeli authorities ambushed Palestinian mourners before they could even leave the premises of a hospital for a procession to Abu Akleh's funeral service. They were forced to place the casket inside a car to be transported to a church for services. This comes 2 days after Shireen Abu Akleh was shot in the head while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. On Thursday, the Al Jazeera network published new video evidence that Palestinian fighters were not in the vicinity of Shireen Abu Akleh when she was killed, and that Israeli troops had a clear line of fire on her position. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas spoke at a state funeral for Abu Akleh held Thursday in Ramallah.
We hold the Israeli occupation authorities fully responsible for her killing, and it will not be able to conceal the truth with this crime. This crime shall not pass without penalty. We would like to point out that we reject and have rejected the joint investigation with the Israeli authorities because it committed this crime and because we don't trust them, and we will immediately approach the international court.
Israeli officials have approved more than 4,000 new homes in illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In response, the Israeli group Peace Now, Shalom Achshav, tweeted, "The state of Israel took another stumble toward the abyss and further deepened the occupation. It's bad news for Israel and for anyone who cares about the people in our region," they said. In Chile, Francisca Sandoval, a 29-year-old journalist who was shot in the head while covering a Workers' Day march on May 1st, has died of her wounds. Sandoval was reportedly shot after a group of men opened fire on the protesters. Two other journalists were also wounded. Sandoval is the first journalist to be killed in the line of duty in Chile since the U.S.-backed Pinochet dictatorship. In Argentina, thousands took to the streets of Buenos Aires Thursday to protest the country's soaring living and food costs. They're demanding the government of President Alberto Fernandez improve social aid programs and have spoken out against Argentina's repayment of a $44 billion debt with the International Monetary Fund, which they say largely burdens the people. This is one of the protesters.
Today, more than 300,000 people are going to be in the Plaza de Mayo to demand of the national government that there be no more hunger, no more misery. We want genuine work, a living wage equal to the basic food basket. We clearly say no to the International Monetary Fund and no to the foreign debt payment.
The protest in Buenos Aires came just days after President Alberto Fernandez announced he'll seek re-election in 2023. North Korea has announced its first COVID-19 death. State media made the admission Friday as it reported some 350,000 North Koreans have been treated after an explosive nationwide outbreak. Sri Lanka's embattled president reimposed a nationwide curfew and swore in a new prime minister Thursday, just days after his brother stepped down from the role amidst massive protests over nepotism, corruption, and a devastating economic crisis. The move did little to quell public anger and opposition. Politicians joined protesters in rejecting the appointment.
This is seriously going against the wishes of the people. We want to say publicly that the president appointing a person rejected by the people and not an independent person, and those lawmakers who support it, will be rejected by the people.
At least 9 people have been killed since supporters of the Sri Lankan president Gotabaya Rajapaksa attacked protesters Monday. More than 300 others have been injured. At least 11 Haitian asylum seekers have died after their boat capsized near the island of Desecho, located off the west coast of Puerto Rico. At least 31 others have been taken into the custody of the U.S. Coast Guard. This comes as a growing number of people continue to flee Haiti due to worsening gang violence, political instability, poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis. Rights groups are condemning Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott over a joint statement he made with the National Border Patrol Council, criticizing the Biden administration for providing asylum-seeking children in U.S. custody with food. Governor Abbott's statement on Thursday read in part, quote, "While mothers and fathers stare at empty grocery store shelves in a panic, the Biden administration's happy to provide baby formula to illegal immigrants coming across our southern border," unquote. Carl Takei, a senior staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union, responded on Twitter, "I can't come up with the words to describe how despicable and inhumane this is. Every child, regardless of whether Governor Abbott and Border Patrol agents consider them our child or not, deserves food and love. We should be shutting down these cages, not turning them into even more horrific places," he said. A U.S. appeals court Wednesday ruled California's ban on the sale of semi-automatic weapons to people under 21 is unconstitutional. A dissent was written by Judge Sidney Stein, who said, quote, "I remain committed to keeping deadly weapons out of the wrong hands. Student safety on our campuses is something we should all rally behind, and sensible gun control is part of that solution," unquote. The two conservative judges who ruled in the majority were appointed by Donald Trump. The Senate voted 80-19 Thursday to confirm Jerome Powell to a second term as chair of the Federal Reserve. Powell assumed the role in 2018 after he was nominated by President Trump. He's promised to combat U.S. inflation, now at a 40-year high. And Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders revived his bill to provide Medicare for all U.S. residents. The measure has 15 Senate co-sponsors, all of them in the Democratic caucus. Sanders unveiled his proposal Thursday at a hearing of the Senate Budget Committee, which he chairs.
"It is not acceptable to me, nor to the American people, that over 70 million Americans today are either uninsured or underinsured. As we speak right now, this moment, there are millions of people in our country who would like to go to a doctor, who have to go to the doctor, but simply cannot afford to do so. This is unacceptable. This is un-American. And this cannot be allowed to happen in the wealthiest country on earth."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new report by the Interior Department has documented the deaths of 500 indigenous children at Indian boarding schools, runners supported by the federal government in the United States, but the actual death toll is believed to be far higher. The report also located 53 burial sites at former schools, which were run for over a century. The report marks the first time the Department of Interior has documented some of the horrific history of the schools, known for their brutal assimilation practices, forcing students to change their clothing, language, and culture. The report was ordered by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is a member of the Laguna Pueblo. Her grandparents were forced to attend boarding school at the age of 8. She spoke on Wednesday.
For more than a century, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were taken from their communities and forced into boarding schools run by the U.S. government, specifically the Department of the Interior and religious institutions. When my maternal grandparents were only 8 years old, they were stolen from their parents' culture and communities and forced to live in boarding schools until the age of 13. Many children like them never made it back to their homes. The federal policies that attempted to wipe out Native identity, language, and culture continue to manifest in the pain tribal communities face today, including cycles of violence and abuse, disappearance of Indigenous people, premature deaths, poverty and loss of wealth, mental health disorders, and substance abuse. Recognizing the impacts of the federal Indian boarding school system cannot just be a historical reckoning. We must also chart a path forward to deal with these legacy issues. The fact that I am standing here today as the first Indigenous Cabinet Secretary is testament to the strength and determination of Native people. I am here because my ancestors persevered. I stand on the shoulders of my grandmother and my mother. And the work we will do with the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative will have a transformational impact on the generations who follow.
That was Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. On Thursday, Matthew Warbonnet, who was brought to a boarding school on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota at the age of 6, testified about his experience before the House Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples.
My boarding school experience is very painful and traumatic. I remember when I first got to school, the priest took us to his big room, which had 6 or 8 bathtubs in it. The priest took all us little guys and put us in one tub, and he scrubbed us hard with a big brush. The brush made our skins and our backsides all raw. And we had to have our hair cut. The school then put all the little guys in the same dormitory. We were together the first through fourth grades. At nighttime, you could hear all the children crying.
To talk more about the history of Indian boarding schools, runners supported by the U.S. government, we're joined by Nick Estes in Minneapolis, writer, historian, author of the book Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. He's co-founder of the Indigenous Resistance Group, the Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. Nick, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this new Interior Department report.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. And as you could hear in the voices of the people, Secretary Haaland, this is a very emotional experience for a lot of Indigenous people in this country, and it should be an emotional experience for non-Indigenous people in this country. This is quite a historic moment in time. Although it's not new news to Indigenous people, it might be new news to those who are hearing this horrific genocidal process that has taken place. I think, there's a reason why the forcibly transferring of children from one group to another group is an international legal definition of genocide. That's what we're talking about, because taking children or the process of Indian child removal has been one strategy for terrorizing Native families for centuries. From the mass removal of Native children from their communities into boarding schools, as this new report lays out from their communities into, you know, their widespread adoption and fostering out to mostly white families, which happened primarily in the 20th century. This is a historic report in that regard, because it documents, I think, for the first time, the federal government admitting to this genocidal process. Of course, they don't use that language in this report, but many of the researchers, most of whom were indigenous, who did the legwork on this first volume, I think it's going to be the first volume of several volumes, to say that this is a widespread, this was a widespread systematic destruction, not just of our culture, but of our nations, as well as an open, you know, theft of land. And I think that's important to talk about here, that settler colonialism isn't just about targeting Native people because they hate our culture, our language, or our religion. But this boarding school system came at a time when the United States government, at the turn of the 19th century to the 20th century, was looking to consolidate its western frontier through the Dawes Allotment Act, which resulted in, you know, hundreds of millions of acres of Indian territory being opened up for white settlement, and using Indian children as hostages. And that's the language of the policy reformers at the time. That's the language that they were using. They were saying, we are going to use these children as hostages for the quote unquote good behavior of their people.
Now, you have visited and reported on one particular Indian boarding school, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that was opened in 1879. Can you talk about that as an example of what took place around this country?
Carlisle really became the archetype of off-reservation Indian boarding schools. And in fact, the Carlisle Indian School, the first classes that entered were from Lakota people, my nation, from specifically the Pine Ridge and Rosebud agencies, because we had put up historic resistance against the Dawes Allotment Act. And it was a way to essentially break the tribal bonds of our people. And so that first class that went, it's documented in Luther Standing Bear's two autobiographies that he wrote. He's from the Rosebud Sioux tribe. And he talks about these schools as not being so much schools, but as prisoner of war camps, where they didn't learn, you know, the ABCs or, you know, language and mathematics, the things that you would expect to learn at schools. Instead, they learned military discipline because, you know, General Pratt or Colonel Pratt, he was a military man. And this was a strange arrangement between the U.S. military and the Department of Interior to run this off-reservation boarding school. But the militarized discipline became instilled in many of the off-reservation boarding schools, as well as the inculcation of U.S. patriotism, flag worship, and religious obedience. And so the first classes that went to the Carlisle Indian School, according to the testimony of Luther Standing Bear, who was part of that first incoming class, half of them didn't even return home. Many of them died at that school. So it's kind of a misnomer to actually call these educational institutions or schools themselves when you didn't have very many people graduating, let alone surviving the dire conditions of those schools. And in this report, they document the forced labor, the unpaid labor of Native children was used to essentially subsidize the lack of resources that the federal government was not providing to Indian education at this time, too. So it was a horrific experience for those of, you know, for those who didn't make it out, but it was also a horrific experience for those who did make it out. And to this day, at the entrance of the Carlisle Indian School, there's a cemetery of hundreds of gravestones. And many tribal nations, including the Rosebud Sioux tribe, have been working on returning their ancestors. Some of them have been successful, but it's also important to point out that some of the children that died there are from tribal nations that don't, you know, that have protocols around not disturbing, you know, their ancestors when they're interred into the earth. And so this is a very delicate situation. It's not just the problem of the federal government. It's also the problem of the U.S. military.
So
because this is an active It's an active military base. I think that's important to point out, too.
Nick Estes, research by Preston McBride at Dartmouth. Dartmouth College has suggested as many as 40,000 Native American children died at government-run boarding schools around the U.S. This report is saying 500. Can you talk more about this discrepancy?
Yeah, I think in the press briefing by the Department of Interior yesterday, it was pointed out by Deb Holland as well as Assistant Secretary Brian Newland that this was a preliminary report. And that they've identified over 53 marked or unmarked grave sites at these various off-reservation boarding schools and on-reservation boarding schools. And I think it's a really delicate matter because, you know, for example, the Rapid City Indian School, which is, you know, in Rapid City, South Dakota, the burial sites are actually within the community itself. There have been housing projects that have been built over the burial sites. And a lot of people are reluctant to identify them publicly because of the history of grave robbing at a lot of these sites. And so I think, you know, what Preston is saying is very true that this is an undercount because it's an initial survey of these specific grave sites. But I think as this investigation goes underway and more documents become, you know, available for the public, we're going to see those numbers continue to rise. And it's very tragic. I think it's important to point out that this initiative began last June when, you know, several hundred Native children's graves were found in Canada. But where are the headlines now about all the, you know, the surveys that a lot of these First Nations are doing at these sites? And the numbers are in the thousands right now, but it's not making headlines, you know? And so I think it's important to pay attention to this as it unfolds and to really listen to a lot of the Native elders, as well as the Native researchers who have been doing this historically. This isn't new news to us, you know? We don't have a definitive number. All we have is the common experience of the boarding school system as it has affected every single American Indian in this country.
Do you have reservations about the report? In fact, it's true the Interior Department report said they expect to find thousands, if not tens of thousands, of deaths. But you're talking about a report that was released by the Interior Department and worked on by the Bureau of Indian Affairs within that, which actually ran the whole boarding school system. But the new development, of course, is Deb Holland is in charge, the first Native American cabinet member in U.S. history.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that, you know, Deb Holland is, you know, I think she's been in this position for just over a year now. And 1 year is, you know, in the face of, you know, a century and a half of genocidal Indian policy, isn't that much, you know, when we think about how these, you know, how history unfolds. But also, I think it's important to point out that the perpetrator of this crime against humanity is now going to be the adjudicator of justice, so to speak. And there were questions of Deb Holland's office yesterday about what reparations will look like on behalf of tribes. They're modeling their truth and reconciliation process off of the Canadian model. But it's important to point out that the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission only came about because of a class action lawsuit on behalf of residential school survivors. And I would say that the Department of Interior has a poor track record in terms of, you know, adjudicating and accounting for its own crimes. You know, we can look at the Cole Bell settlement, which happened in 2011. The banker, Eloise Cole Bell, she was from the Blackfoot Nation. She did a forensic audit of, you know, the United States, and found that the federal government had mismanaged $176 billion of individual Indian monies. And the Department of Interior awarded itself, because we're still considered wards of the government, $3.5 billion. That's, you know, almost pennies on the dollar of what she had accounted for in terms of damages that we were awarded. And so, you know, it's no coincidence that Indian people are in the same department that manages wildlife and federal lands. You know, we have, I heard earlier in the broadcast that the Department of Interior is kind of going back on this, overt federal leasing program. You know, but it's not just the question of Indian boarding schools. It's all, you know, because Indian boarding schools were one facet of a larger, you know, process of dispossession and theft of indigenous, you know, people's lands and resources, because the Indian boarding school system was actually using treaty annuities and federal funds that was meant for Indian education for this genocidal process. And this money was gained through the selling of our land to white settlers. It was also gained through the dispossession of those lands by the federal government itself. And so there's a lot of accounting to be done here. And, you know, the report itself identifies 39,000 boxes of materials that the federal government has. I think it's about over 9 million pages of documents that need to be reviewed. And so allocating just $7 million to this investigative process over a century and a half of genocidal policies is kind of a drop in the bucket in what needs to happen. And I think it is important to point out that there is, you know, there is Representative Sharice Davis, who's a Democrat from Kansas and also from an indigenous nation herself, has a bill that's going through Congress right now that'll open up, I think, more federal money for an investigative process that'll look not only into the federal Indian boarding school system, but also look into the role of faith groups, specifically the Catholic Church, and its role in these genocidal educational policies.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow all of this. But Nick Estes, before we end, I wanted to ask you about Leonard Peltier, the 77-year-old Anishinaabe Lakota Native American activist who's been in prison for 46 years for a crime he says he did not commit. Leonard Peltier was a member of the American Indian Movement, convicted of involvement in the killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. His arrest and trial marred by prosecutorial misconduct, withheld evidence, coerced and fabricated eyewitness testimony, and more. Amnesty International has long called him a political prisoner. In late April, Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz asked Attorney General Merrick Garland about calls to grant Peltier clemency.
Final question, easy one. What is your position on clemency for Leonard Peltier?
So this is a matter that goes into applications, go to the pardon attorney. Pardon attorney makes recommendations through the Deputy Attorney General to the President. And so I'm not going to comment on that now. So,
can you comment on where we are in the process?
I assume but don't know that an application has been made. I actually don't even know whether, I mean, I've read about this in the press, so I don't know anything more about it than what I've read in the press.
And this doesn't cross your desk?
Certainly not as an initial or even secondary matter. This goes to the pardon attorney and then the Deputy Attorney General. I'm not saying I wouldn't be involved, but it certainly has not crossed my desk.
Thank you very much.
Nick Estes, can you talk about Leonard Peltier? You recently co-wrote a piece for The Guardian headlined, "Leonard Peltier is America's longest-held indigenous prisoner. He should be freed."
Yeah, it's important to point out, first of all, Leonard Peltier is a product of this federal Indian boarding school system. His name was actually mentioned in the press conference yesterday on this particular initiative. And in fact, it's also important to point out that during her tenure as a congresswoman for New Mexico, Deb Haaland was a strident advocate for Leonard Peltier's release. And so we're seeing a growing momentum around the question of Leonard Peltier's continued unjust imprisonment. And, you know, the Obama administration had an opportunity to correct the course of, you know, history in releasing, you know, Leonard Peltier, granting him clemency, because that's the only option on the table right now for his release. But he is an elder. He's an endeared elder to his community. Turtle Mountain Ojibwe have a plan in place so that once he is released, he has housing and he's taken in by the community itself. You have Representative Ruth Buffalo from North Dakota, who's up for re-election this year, who's been a strident advocate for Leonard Peltier, who talks to Leonard Peltier on a weekly basis. And so you have this massive support from Indian country, from elected officials to tribal governments advocating for his release. And if we want true justice in this country, whether it's for the boarding school system, something that Leonard Peltier himself was fighting against as part of the American Indian movement, then we also need to, you know, not only advocate for his release, but advocate for a full congressional investigation into the conditions that led to the shootout at the Jumping Bull property in 1975. And the multiple, the tens, you know, the dozens of deaths that have gone unsolved on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation during the so-called Reign of Terror following the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973. And so this is an open wound for Indian country, and it's an open wound for the federal government. And his committee is advocating for healing. And the first step of that process is to grant him clemency. At this point, there's no reason other than vindictive revenge for him to be in prison. He survived COVID. He's in poor health, and the man deserves to be with his people.
Why don't we end with Leonard Peltier's voice? By the way, his new attorney is a former chief judge from Tennessee. But I spoke to Leonard, 10 years ago. That's this clip on the phone in a Florida prison.
Leonard, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now. I was
wondering.
Hi, I'm good. I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
I just hope he can, stop the wars that are going on in the world and stop killing all those people getting killed and give the Black Hills back to my people and turn me loose.
Can you share with people at the news conference and with President Obama your case for why you should be, your sentence should be commuted, why you want clemency?
Well, I never got a fair trial, for one. They wouldn't allow me to put up a defense and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses. The list just goes on. So I think I'm a very good candidate for after 37 years for clemency or house arrest, at least.
I was speaking to Leonard Peltier at a public forum a day after a major event at the Beacon Theater had taken place in his honor and to raise money for his support here in New York City. Well, Nick Estes, we thank you for being with us. Writer, historian, author of Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline, long tradition of indigenous resistance, co-founder of Red Nation. You can link to all of our interviews with Leonard Peltier, as well as my questioning of President Clinton at the time, whether he would be granting clemency. And you hear Leonard Peltier himself talking about asking President Obama for that. Now the question is, what will President Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland do? This is Democracy Now! Next up, we go to Mexico, where three journalists have been killed in the last week, bringing the toll to 11 so far this year, making Mexico the deadliest country in the world for journalists behind Ukraine. Stay with us.
Se alborotaron las aguas del puerto de
Vivir Quintana, the central character of the song, is Mexican journalist Miguel Ángel López Velasco, who was murdered in 2011 along with his wife and son in Veracruz, Mexico. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we stay in Mexico right now, where three journalists have been killed this week, bringing the toll to 11 so far this year, making Mexico the deadliest country in the world for journalists behind Ukraine. In the eastern state of Veracruz, Yesenia Mojinedo Falcone and Sheila Joanna Garcia Oliveira were fatally shot by two men on board a motorcycle outside a convenience store this past Monday. 45-year-old Falcone was the director of the online news site El Veraz. Oliveira, who was 24, was a reporter at the same outlet. Over the past year, Falcone had publicly spoken about receiving frequent death threats over her work over the past year and a half. News of their deaths came as journalists across Mexico took to the streets protesting the murder of yet another reporter, this in the northern state of Sinaloa, Luis Enrique Ramirez, a columnist at the newspaper El Debate, covering local and state politics, among other issues. The 59-year-old was found killed last Thursday near a dirt road in the city of Culiacán, wrapped in black plastic and with severe head wounds. This week, journalists gathered in outrage in Mexico City.
The wave of murders against the journalistic profession has become uncontrollable. Today, just as we are protesting here in Mexico City, in Tijuana and in Sinaloa, we learned the sad news that two of our colleagues were taken from their lives in Veracruz. It is carnage against journalists in our country. There are no guarantees. The Mexican state is not providing the guarantees so that we can freely exercise our journalistic exercise in Mexican territory.
And this is Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador responding to the three most recent killings during a news conference this week.
An investigation is already underway. We will soon have a report. What happened is, of course, unfortunate, and we send an embrace to the family members of the victims.
AMLO's response comes amidst intense criticism that he's allowed reporters to be murdered with impunity during his 6 years in office and attacked critical journalists as mercenaries who want to undermine his administration. A total of 11 journalists have already been killed in Mexico so far this year. The other eight are Armando Linares López, José Luis Gamboa, Margarito Martinez, Lourdes Maldonado, Roberto Toledo, Eber Fernando López, Jorge Camero, and Juan Carlos Muñiz. For more, we're joined in Mexico City by Jan Albert Hudson, Dutch journalist and Mexico correspondent at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Jan Albert, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about this spate of killings in the last week? Three journalists, two at one organization, one in another state, who they are.
Thanks for having me. These were journalists who mostly worked for smaller regional outlets. For example, Margarito Martinez, a photographer in Tijuana, Lourdes Maldonado had an online talk show, Armando Linares y Roberto Toledo, who worked for a local news show, local news website in Michoacán called Monitor Michoacán. So mostly what they have in common is that they work for smaller outlets, they work in smaller community, and as such are extremely visible, very highly visible and easy to trace down, which probably added to the risk that they were running as reporters.
You've met with some of the family members. Can you tell us what they have said? Also, some of these reporters who were murdered actually raised their concerns, having gotten death threats before, all the way up to AMLO, the president of Mexico.
Yes, that's right. Specifically, Lourdes Maldonado, a reporter from Tijuana who was murdered earlier this year, traveled to Mexico City last year and actually told President López Obrador that she felt threatened, that she felt that her life was at risk. And she had actually applied for protective measures from the Baja California state government. Other reporters, such as Armando Linares, who was also murdered, warned about the risks that he was running as a reporter just weeks before his collaborator, Roberto Toledo, and about 2 months before he himself was killed. So these are reporters who are usually very aware of the fact that they are running risks, that they may face reprisals for their reporting, which is usually about organized crime or corruption or abuse by the authorities. And as you mentioned, yesterday I spoke with the brother of Yesenia Mollinedo, the reporter who was killed in Veracruz, and he told us that his family feels extremely exposed, that they have been in touch with federal and state authorities, but that they feel that the response by the authorities has been woefully insufficient and that they still feel that their life is at risk. Should be noted that Ramiro Mollinedo, the brother of Yesenia, is a reporter himself, and that he also focuses on organized crime and corruption and abuse by authorities in the region where he's working. So that he, like the other reporters who were killed, is very keenly aware that he's running extreme risks.
Yeah, and Albert, can you tell us more about Yesenia and Sheila and their news organization, El Veraz, as well as Luis Enrique Ramirez? I mean, this is just astounding. There's a lot of attention being paid to the journalists in Ukraine. But, I mean, we're talking about three in the last week, three reporters, and that brings to 11 just this year, and we're only in May.
The numbers are staggering, aren't they? I think we're dealing with what might be the deadliest year in modern Mexican history for the press, comparable to, for example, 2017, when a number of reporters were killed in February and March. And specifically the three latest cases, I know that Yesenia and Juana, her collaborator, worked for a small local news website in the southern part of the state of Veracruz called El Veraz. The site was founded about 7 years ago and focused mostly on local politics and the goings on in the Coatzacoalcos area in Veracruz. And Yesenia also covered organized crime in the past. Her brother told me that she stopped covering organized crime several months ago after she had received numerous death threats. She had reported those several years ago, but also by the end of last year. And of Juana, we don't know all that much. We know that she started working with Yesenia a few months ago. She already had press credentials, and then she was supposedly hired as a camera operator. Luis Enrique Ramirez, on the other hand, was a reporter who worked for a local news website that he himself had co-founded called Fuentes Fidedignas, where he focused mostly on local politics. But he was more widely known in Sinaloa as a gifted, talented political columnist for El Debate, which is one of the bigger newspapers in Sinaloa. And Luis Enrique Ramirez was actually more widely known amongst journalists in the country as being a protege of several very well-known writers and journalists such as Carlos Monsiváis and Elena Poniatowska. He was a very critical, independent mind and very well-liked by his readers and by his colleagues.
Now, Jan Albert, you're traveling to Sinaloa today, is that right? Because it's the fifth anniversary of the murder of Javier Valdez of La Jornada. Talk about the significance of that, and right through to now, 5 years later, another journalist killed.
So Javier Valdez Cárdenas was one of the most well-known journalists in Mexico, especially of those working outside the Mexico City metropolitan area. And when he was killed 5 years ago, it came as a shock for a lot of people, myself included, not only because he was the recipient of the CPJ International Press Freedom Award, an award that we give out each year, but also because he was a personal friend of mine. I knew him fairly well for about 10 years before he was killed. And I think the consequences of his death are still echoing into the here and now, because when such a high-profile journalist as Javier Valdez was killed, he was very likely killed because of his writing about organized crime in Sinaloa. That it means that very few journalists are actually not at risk here in Mexico.
Yeah, now, Albert, I wanted to go for a minute to Javier Valdez speaking at that awards ceremony. You were just talking about the International Press Freedom Awards when he got it from your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, in 2011.
He sido periodista estos 21 años y nunca.
I have been a journalist these past 21 years, and never before have I suffered or enjoyed it this intensely, nor with so many dangers.
En Culiacán, Sinaloa, México.
In Culiacán, in the state of Sinaloa, Mexico, it is dangerous to be alive, and to do journalism is to tread an invisible line drawn by the bad guys, who are in drug trafficking and in the government, in a field strewn with explosives.
Esta es una guerra, sí. Pero por el control del
This is a war, yes.
Pero nosotros,
but one for control by the narcos. But we, the citizens, are providing the deaths. And the Mexican and U.S. governments, the guns. And they, the eminent, invisible, and hidden ones, within and outside of the governments, they take the profits.
So that was Javier Valdez speaking in 2011 when he was receiving his International Press Freedom Award. Jan Albert Hudson, as we wrap up, many journalists are very critical of the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, for not doing more. What can be done? What are the demands being made right now?
I think it's not an easy question to answer, what can be done, because the problem is so widespread and so deeply ingrained in Mexican society. But I think the best way the Mexican government could go about this, and answering your question about what are the demands, is first and foremost, he should invest far more heavily in law enforcement, in prosecutors and police, in best practices, in specifically addressing the components that are very particular to the murders of journalists. He should also improve the security of journalists by strengthening institutions that have been created to protect reporters and human rights defenders. And something that specifically President López Obrador really has to do, he has to stop polarizing, antagonizing journalists and creating this divide between Mexican citizens and reporters, because right now his polarizing attitude towards the press makes it a lot harder for us to convey the urgency of the problem, that a crime against a reporter is a crime against the entire country.
Jan Albert Hudson, I want to thank you for being with us, Dutch journalist and Mexico correspondent at the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to us from Mexico. Next up, Russia's threatening to take retaliatory steps after Finland's leaders announced plans to join NATO. Stay with us.
Big smile.
Pussy Riot. One of the band's members, Maria Alekhina, escaped from Russia to Lithuania this week. She was disguised as a food delivery person, evading police, staking out the apartment where she was staying. The band is now going on tour in support and solidarity with the people of Ukraine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Finland's president and prime minister announced their support Thursday for Finland to join NATO, ending decades of neutrality. The leaders called on Finland to apply for NATO membership without delay. Finland shares an 830-mile border with Russia. Sweden's also expected to join Finland in seeking NATO membership, something few discussed prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russia responded to the news by threatening to take retaliatory steps in order to stop what it calls threats to its national security. The New York Times reports the addition of Finland and Sweden to NATO increases the prospects of a broader war between Russia and the West. We go now to Berlin, Germany, where we're joined by Rainer Braun, the executive director of the International Peace Bureau, German peace activist, historian, author, who's campaigned for years against NATO. Can you talk about this decision made by Finland's president and prime minister? And the significance of this, it looks like Sweden is, at their side in this.
You know, it's again a significant change in the security system in Europe. Above all and first, it is a break of a contract. Finland has a contract with Russia. First contract is from 1948, the second one and the new one from 1992, which described neutrality and friendship between Finland and Russia at the background of their common relations. and Finland has not had not canceled these treaties, so they are going against this treaty, which is a quite a legal action they are doing. The second point is the relations between Central Europe or NATO and Russia by the military spending is about 15-1 up to now. Now it will be 17 or 18-1. And it is obviously that Russia will react. So we have again a continuation of the escalation spiral in the center of Europe. And this is not peaceful. What should be the next? Should be the next Moldavia and Georgia? Should be the next that Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan will join NATO? It will be the next Japan. And what are the reactions of Russia? They will bring more nuclear weapons to the border of Poland and the Baltic countries. They will enlarge their military spending. People on both sides will suffer. So it is definitely a step absolutely on the wrong direction, which is definitely not helpful for coming to a new security architecture after hopefully ending so quick as possible the war in Ukraine. What we need are negotiations, and for Finland, which is a history in neutrality. Finland was a country of the OSCE and the KSCE agreements. There was a meeting there in Helsinki. This time will be over. Finland will give up his independent, active position, bringing East and West together, only for joining NATO, only for being a very small part in the NATO architecture. This is really an unpolitical and unsecurity step for a common security system in Europe.
Can you talk about the letter that you helped co-write both to President Putin and President Zelensky of Ukraine calling for a ceasefire?
You know, for us was May 9th, a historical day, which made Europe free from fascism. And the countries which bring the most victims were the Soviet Union, which include Russia and Ukraine. So our letter was to say, when you make your speeches on the 8th or the 9th of May, after these speeches, you should come together and negotiate for peace in the tradition of the victory about the fascist system. And you should think about ways how you can combine again the people of these two countries, which have so many things in common, which have so many things in a common history. There are so many things together in the languages, in the agriculture system, in the treaties, in educational system, and we have to overcome this horrible split between these two countries. And the first point which we're calling for was and is ceasefire. The 8th and the 9th of May passed. It is a pity that we could not start with the negotiations, but we will continue working on ceasefire. And I think we need more international pressure for these negotiations. And for me, the Pope was sending a very interesting and very hopeful sign for starting these negotiations. I hope other political leaders in the world, maybe Macron, maybe Xi from China, will follow to bring these two countries, Russia and Ukraine, at the same table for negotiating.
Can you explain what the peace summit you and a number of other groups are planning in June in Spain?
You know, there is a NATO summit. And NATO is the biggest military alliance in the world. NATO is the biggest military spender. 60% of the whole money which is spending worldwide is spending by the NATO countries. So in these NATO summit will send signs in the absolutely wrong direction. More militarization, more actions against Russia and China, more encircling of these two countries. And we want to protest and convince more parts of the public that this is the wrong way. This is the way in the catastrophe. This is the way in a new nuclear war, which will be the final nuclear war. We cannot do this kind of politics when you want to solve the climate problem, when you want to overcome hunger. Hunger becomes much stronger since we have the Ukrainian war. How should these people in Africa survive when there are no crops any longer coming from Ukraine and Russia? So we want to say signs that we need an alternative politics. So our summit is a summit for making propaganda and actions for a policy of common security, which on the background says we have to take into account the security interests of all countries, and we need nationally and internationally a process of disarmament. It is not possible to spend any longer $2 trillion of U.S. dollars for military purposes when people are suffering and when we do not know how to solve the climate problems.
Well, Rainer Braun, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the International Peace Bureau, German peace activist, historian and author who's campaigned against a U.S. air base in Ramstein and also against NATO. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warnoff, Camille Baker, Trina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Pruden, Dennis McCormick. I'll be moderating a panel on voices beyond the borders at the PEN America Global Festival here in New York. Check our website at democracynow.org. It's Saturday at the Judson Church. Stay.